Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk, the most fact-driven, unbiased, true crime channel. Let's get straight to the docket today. First, the latest on the Gabby Petito matter. Second, some nuggets from the Barry Morphew arrest affidavit. More royals are coming to America. The McCloskeys are back in the news. And a little good news. And then finally, our dumb criminal contestant of the day, International Edition. Let's talk about it. Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. This is Crime Talk. My name is Scott Reich. Thanks for watching. We have a busy docket, but before we get started on that, a couple of things. First, we are going live tonight, 6 p.m. Mountain Time. Please join us immediately following our live show. We will do our Patreon show, which gives our Patreon members the opportunity to call in and chat and have questions along with some hopefully good conversation. All right. First, now, we never know exactly when tragedy or a natural disaster is going to strike, but the one thing you know you need to do is to be prepared. And what's the best way to be prepared for the unexpected? Well, you're going to need food and you're going to need water. Where should you get the food? You're probably not going to be able to run down to the local grocery store. So that's why you need to go to crimetalkprep.com and sign up and get your 4-week supply of emergency food rations. You're going to get $50 off and free delivery. You'll be happy you did. Go to crimetalkprep.com. All right, let's get straight to the docket. Obviously, the Gabby Petito matter. Well, a National Park Service ranger who responded to a domestic violence incident between Brian Laundrie and Gabby Petito in Utah last month warned the woman that her relationship with Laundrie seemed toxic. Melissa Hulls, the visitor and resource protection supervisor at Arches National Park, said that she was probably more candid with her than I should have been. Now, by the time Hulls responded that day, Petito, 22, was sobbing in the back of a police cruiser, and the ranger approached her knowing that the Long Island native might be more comfortable speaking with a woman during the emotional ordeal. Now, Hulls was imploring with Gabby to reevaluate the relationship and asking if she was happy being in a relationship with Laundrie. She even said that this was an opportunity for Gabby to find another path and to make a change in her life. Now, police responded after a 911 caller reported seeing a man slapping a woman in the face. According to the new audio obtained, the audio contradicts a police report that portrayed Petito as the aggressor, stating at one point that she began slapping him after he told her to take a walk to calm down. Police body cam footage of the incident has been released by the Moab City Police Department. Now, Hulls was also wearing a body camera, but said she has not looked over that particular footage. And she says, it's hard not to second guess myself, and I wish I had said more or wish I had found the right words to make her believe that she deserved more. In other Gabby Petito news, a search warrant issued last week shows that authorities in Northport, Florida, obtained a hard drive from a computer that was found in Petito's vehicle 4 days after she was reported missing. The warrant authorizes investigators to withdraw possible evidence from the hard drive, including digital forensics, passwords, and records of online communications. Now, new documents present a new account of Petito's last communication with her parents. It was previously reported that Petito received a text message from Petito on August 30th that read, "No service in Yosemite," which raised eyebrows since Yosemite is in California and Gabby was supposed to be in the national park in Wyoming. Gabby's mother, Nicole Schmidt, previously told authorities that she thought this text might not have been sent by her daughter. These newly released documents show a text message Petito sent to her mother on August 27th in reference to a man believed to be Petito's grandfather. The message read, "Can you help Stan?" I just keep getting his voicemails and missed calls. Petito's mother was concerned something was wrong with her daughter since she never refers to her grandfather as Stan. Meanwhile, back at the laundry house in Florida, FBI agents spent most of yesterday executing a search warrant regarding the search of the home in connection with Gabby Petito. Initially, the FBI escorted the parents out of the house and into a van parked in the front yard. After about an hour, the couple was allowed back into their home. The FBI also towed Brian Laundrie's Ford Mustang from the property Monday afternoon. Christopher and Roberta Laundrie told detectives on Friday that their son had left the house to go hiking 3 days earlier, and they hadn't heard from him since. Well, search teams have been searching the Carlton Reserve all day on Saturday and Sunday, but on Monday said they'd exhausted all avenues and would not return to the reserve. They were still searching for Laundrie, according to the police. On Tuesday, Northport police spokesperson Josh Taylor said in an email statement that investigators were returning to the Carlton Reserve to resume the search for Laundrie. In the email statement, Taylor warned teams, saying this is a dangerous work environment for the search crews as they are wading through gator and snake-infested swamps and flooded hiking and biking trails. The Northport police tweeted pictures this morning of police vehicles and drones searching the reserves with the caption, "By land, by air." Now, the Laundrie family attorney had scheduled a press conference for today, but has since canceled, giving no reason as to why. Also today, a medical examiner is scheduled to perform an autopsy on the human remains found in Wyoming on Sunday. The autopsy is expected to provide a positive identification and information about the cause and manner of death. Obviously, everyone believes these are the remains of Gabby Petito. We will keep you apprised of any new developments. We'll see if old Brian Laundrie harmed himself, or did maybe his parents give him a head start with the authorities. Let me know in the comments what you think. All right, well, yesterday we brought you the news that the 130-page arrest affidavit was finally released in the Barry Morphew matter, and he posted, get this, a $500,000 cash bond. Do you think you could do that? Do you think that you would have somebody that would post $500,000 for you? Barry does, and his daughters were there to greet him. Now, the affidavit reveals some details of the investigation that were not included in the four-day-long preliminary hearing, including a coworker who recounted his conversation with Barry Morphew on May 9th of 2020, in which he said he could bury a body and it would never be found. You have to take these with context, and also the district attorney must not have had great confidence in this statement, otherwise they would have brought it to the preliminary hearing. Now, the affidavit further states that Morphew refused to take a polygraph test. Now, remember, you don't have to take a polygraph test, and polygraph tests are not admissible in court because they are deemed unreliable. They are simply a tool of interrogation. Remember how Chris Watts took that polygraph test and failed miserably, and then he just crumbled? Well, Morphew said he didn't want to do anything that wasn't 100% accurate. But apparently a day or two later, he said something quite different when a friend suggested that he should just take the polygraph. Barry apparently looked at him and said, "I don't think I'd pass a polygraph." This is all according to the affidavit. The friend apparently waited in an uncomfortable silence for a few moments to allow Barry to qualify his statement. He apparently got chills from Barry's response and thought Barry's reaction was very strange. The affidavit also points out several inconsistencies across the many interviews investigators had with Morphew. Among them, saying he and Suzanne had steaks the night before she disappeared. There was only one set of dirty dishes in the house. Detectives also said that he said he woke up at 4:30 a.m. to go to work the day his wife disappeared, but no alarm was set on his phone. Additionally, he left early for work and failed to pick up a coworker as the two had agreed earlier. Now, investigators believe Barry Morphew killed his wife on May 9th, likely because Suzanne insisted on a divorce. The court found probable cause to bind the case over for trial. However, it doesn't necessarily mean that the prosecution is going to be able to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. These type of statements, if they're even admissible at court, can easily be explained by the defense. Remember, there will be no reference, no conversation whatsoever at trial in regards to polygraphs. Completely inadmissible, not coming in, and someone's unwillingness to not take a polygraph test is certainly not coming in at trial. Barry Morphew is out of custody. He has to stay in Chaffee or Chaffee County, depending on where you are here in the state of Colorado. And it's also somewhat interesting that the supervision of his GPS has been modified because one of the pretrial services officers has a relationship with one of the Morphew daughters. You gotta love small towns. Additionally, Barry Morphew cannot leave the county except to have his GPS serviced or to go to Denver to see his attorneys. I guarantee you the prosecution is going to be watching his every move while on that GPS unit. And if he deviates anywhere or goes anywhere in the county, I can guarantee you the police will be checking what he is checking on. All right, next on the docket, the Royals are coming. More Royals are coming to America, and maybe not for the best reason. That's right, Prince Andrew, you know, the royal, who not so royal much anymore. Well, he has finally been served with a lawsuit alleging a sexual assault of a woman who says that she was forced to have sex with him at the London home of Ghislaine Maxwell. Now, in a filing with the U.S. District Court in Manhattan, lawyers for Virginia Jeffrey said she sent the civil lawsuit to the Prince's Los Angeles-based lawyer, Andrew Brettler, by email and FedEx, and both copies had been received by Monday morning. Under the federal rules, the old Duke of York, Prince Andrew, has 21 days to respond or could face a default judgment. Now, Andrew and his lawyers have denied Jeffrey's claim. The 61-year-old prince has not been charged with any crimes. Now, Jeffrey's August 9th lawsuit seeks unspecified damages. Jeffrey, 38, accused Andrew of forcing her to engage in intercourse when she was underage at a London home of Epstein's longtime associate, Ghislaine Maxwell. She also said Andrew abused her at around the same time at Epstein's mansion in Manhattan and on Epstein's private island in the U.S. Virgin Islands. You still have to wonder, how is this underage girl traveling the world? It still begs the question, like, where were her parents? Not saying that she deserves to have anything happen to her, but you really kind of wonder, how did her parents let this happen? Now, the U.S. District Judge who's going to be handling the case, Louis Kaplan, who oversees Jeffrey's lawsuit, has urged both sides not to dwell on technicalities and instead to focus on the case's substance. Now, the technicalities may be whether serving the attorney who hasn't agreed to accept service of process is sufficient service at all. Somehow, I think that the court may get a motion from the old royals that this was not proper service. However, of course, they've received it, so therefore, they should probably respond. Hence, don't fight over the technicalities. Now, last week in London, their high court said it would arrange for Andrew to be served if the parties failed to work out their own arrangements and gave the prince's lawyer a week to appeal that decision. A source close to the Duke's lawyer said it was highly unlikely any challenge would be pursued now. Now, Maxwell has pled not guilty to the criminal charges that she helped recruit and groom underage girls for that guy named Jeff to abuse them. Her trial is set to begin November 29th. Hopefully, it will go forward. I can't wait to hear all the juicy details and see whose names come up in the trial. Let me know if you're excited as well. Guess who's back in the news? That's right. Those St. Louis lawyers, the McCloskeys. Now, it's been more than a year since the St. Louis lawyers, Patricia McCloskey and Mark McCloskey, were first seen on a viral video pointing firearms to racial justice demonstrators outside their mansion after the George Floyd murder. Now, the city prosecutors charged them with felonies in July of 2020, and they were pled down to misdemeanors. The governor, Mike Parsons, pardoned the couple after about a month of their convictions. According to the Supreme Court of Missouri's Chief Disciplinary Officer, Alan Pratzel, the governor's act has no impact on the possible professional consequences for the lawyer couple. In other words, in Missouri, a pardon obliterates a person's conviction, but the person's guilt may still remain, which means that they can still be punished professionally, i.e. possibly have their license suspended or something done to their license if the disciplinary board deems it appropriate. I'm not exactly sure what rule they would have violated, other than obviously they should be there to uphold the law. You have to report that, but that's not necessarily something that would warrant a disbarment or even a suspension. It may just get some sort of public admonishment. Now, as you may recall, the McCloskeys stood outside of their home pointing the guns at protesters, and the mayor then criticized the two for having doxxed people who wanted to defund the police department. Now, the couple maintained that they were acting in self-defense. And although Mark McCloskey pled guilty to a fourth-degree assault and Patricia McCloskey to a second-degree harassment, the husband, who is running for U.S. Senate, has actually boasted about what he did and is not apologetic whatsoever. Let me know. Do you think that they were right? Do you think they should have even been charged? And do you think they should have any sort of disciplinary action at all? Now for some good news. A New Jersey police officer is being praised for his heroic efforts after catching an infant who was dropped from a second-floor balcony. On Saturday, officers from the Jersey City Police Department responded to an alarm report of an infant being in danger after an unidentified man threatened to throw the one-month-old baby from the second-story window. When authorities arrived to the scene, they surrounded the building and attempted to negotiate with the man. However, he eventually did throw the infant. The Hudson County Prosecutor's Office said Officer Eduardo Matute sprang into action and safely caught the child. Following the incident, Faloup shared a photo on Instagram of Matute holding the baby while at the hospital, noting that the child was not physically harmed from the incident. Jersey City spokesperson Kimberly Wallace said the man was arrested and charged with attempted murder, aggravated assault, and endangering the welfare of a child. The Jersey City Police Officer Benevolent Association President Joe Casolini also applauded first responders Joseph Casey and Officer Edward Matute. Nice job, officers. Nice to hear great things going on in the community instead of always some bad news. Now, obviously, the man that wanted to throw the child from the window, he needs to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Next on the docket, our dumb criminal contestant of the day, International Edition today. Two men have been arrested after police say they found them with a car full of, get this, Kentucky Fried Chicken and over $100,000 in cash as they tried to cross the border into Auckland, New Zealand, despite strict COVID-19 lockdowns. Apparently, in such an environment, fast food can take on an aura of high-value illicit substances. Last week, a man was charged by police officers after posting on social media a video of him crossing the Auckland boundary in search of McDonald's. Now, in this case, close examination of the police evidence photos revealed at least three buckets of chicken and up to 10 tubs of coleslaw and an undisclosed quantity of fries. Although it seems frivolous, this apparently was quite a serious breach in New Zealand in their lockdowns. The men will appear in court for breaching the health order, and police say further charges were likely. Now, these two gentlemen, I don't know what you can say. KFC has become the new crack in New Zealand, or the mere fact that they're on lockdown, is that enough to make the dumb criminal? Well, the fact that these guys would risk fast food to become a criminal speaks highly of their desire of fast food, but the fact that they were more than likely going to sell it makes them the dumb criminal of the day. Congratulations, gentlemen. You made it. You can't make this stuff up. All right. Thanks for watching, everyone. We'll see you tonight, 6 p.m. Mountain Time, for our live. And then immediately following that, we will have our Patreon show for all our Patreon members. So if you haven't become a Patreon, now would be a good time to do it. Thanks for watching. We'll see you later tonight on Crime Talk.